It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. I know you thought for a second that Spice Girls were here, but no, it's just me, Bert Martinez, here on Money for Lunch. I appreciate you stopping by. And we love helping business owners here on Money for Lunch. It's really what the show is all about. Bringing you the latest, greatest tips, strategies, and tactics to help you in your business as well as your life. Because you know what? It's all intertwined, right? Anyway, just a spectacular day yesterday. A spectacular day yesterday at Universal Studios. I was invited to be on the show extra with Mr. Mario Lopez, and we were talking about coaching and consulting celebrity brands. So don't, if you haven't seen it, you should go check it out. I haven't even seen it, to be honest with you, and I can't remember if it's airing tonight or tomorrow night. Anyway, look out for it. If not, I'll send you a copy as soon as I get a copy. How's that? We'll make that deal. So good to have you here. Good to... you know, be with you once again. You know, yesterday I made this comment that got me a couple of less than positive remarks via email as well as on Facebook. And so my remarks are this. Social media in general will not make you any money, okay? And the reason for that, it's because it's what's called direct response advertising versus image advertising. So social media in general, posting good, valuable comments, good, valuable posting, articles, whatever you want to call them, interacting with your audience, that's almost what I would consider image type marketing, right? You're not asking them to do business with you, which is one of the reasons that they're not doing business with you, but you're out there, right? They're aware of you, right? And so maybe they're reading your stuff. Most likely not, but maybe they're reading your stuff, they're liking your posts, your pictures, I'm a big fan personally of doing the quotable quotes, the inspirational quotes and stuff like that, and maybe you're doing stuff like that, which is fantastic. It's all okay, but it's not good marketing. What is good marketing? Direct response marketing. What is direct response marketing? Direct response marketing is, hi, I'm Bert. I offer this service, this product, would you like to buy it? Now, of course, that's a kind of a crude method of that, but that's a direct response marketing. They're going to say yes or no. You can do that with email, telemarketing, direct mail, pay-per-click advertising, right? Those are all types of direct response marketing. Image type marketing is things like Coke is the real thing. You're not asking, Coke is not asking you to do anything. They're just kind of telling you, hey, remember Coke? Well, if you're thirsty, maybe kind of remember us again, but they're not asking anything of you. As opposed to if they said, hey, buy 3 cases of Coke for $5, that's direct response marketing. See the difference? See why you're not making any money on social media? Is there an exception? Could you, after posting thousands of hours worth of stuff, get one or two sales, get one or two opt-ins? Of course, but you can't grow a business that way. That's all. So haters gonna hate, and business owners are going to market. And what do you do? What's your big concern after you make tens of thousands of millions of dollars? Well, if you're like me, you're probably concerned about the tax man. And who's going to help you with the tax man? Well, our first guest, Mary King Esquire. Mary King, known as the problem-solving attorney and best author of the book, Protect and Defend. Mary's career as an attorney began in 1993 after graduating from Stetson University College of Law. Her career in law has primarily focused in IRS problem solving as well as mortgage foreclosure defense. Mary has been practicing law for over 23 years and enjoys helping her clients remove the dark cloud of the IRS. Mary King, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here, as always. You know, I think this is the most fun anybody ever has when they're talking or dealing with the IRS.
Probably it is. I think you had a better thing, though. You got to go to Universal yesterday.
It was great. I got to go to Universal, and we had a lot of fun, and got to go there with the wife and the kids, and we're going to go there again as soon as the show's over. We're going to go hang out at Universal Studios and go do the there's a couple of rides that they specifically enjoyed, the Harry Potter, which I also enjoyed. I'm not a big Harry Potter fan per se, but this ride is a spectacular ride, and we're going to do that, and then we're going to do Walking Dead tour again. That was a lot of fun.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Absolutely. And, you know, the great thing about The Walking Dead is that it immediately reminds you of the IRS.
I
like the way I tied that right back in. That was just my way of tying it back in so we can stay on track. But so let's talk about this. I want to ask you this question. Why is it important to file a change of address form, with the IRS? I don't ever think of informing the IRS when I change my address, but this has become a thing now.
It is, and especially when you have a taxpayer who perhaps has not filed tax returns for several years. And the IRS may send out mail, but they're going to send it out to the last known address that the taxpayer filed a tax return. And there was recently a Court of Appeals case which said that if the IRS mails something to a taxpayer's last known address, that was fine. They didn't have to search out the person. In fact, they specifically said the IRS is not obligated to find them, but the taxpayer has the burden of informing the IRS of address changes. So you may think, well, why is this important? Well, the reason is because the IRS, if you don't file a tax return, the IRS can just assess you taxes. And if you don't get that mail, then you are not going to know about that assessment, and you won't have the opportunity to contest that assessment.
Yes. You know, this is one of those scenarios where, unfortunately, you do want to get your mail from the IRS. You know, and like a lot of things in life, sometimes people will hide their head in the sand, hoping it'll go away. The IRS does not go away; they do not forget. And so, the best thing or the worst thing you could do is try to ignore it or whatever. Because guess what? They have long-reaching arms. They don't forget. And with today's technology, you know, they know where you're at anyway. And if they send it to your old address, like you said, the great example you just gave, and quote, you don't get the letter, it doesn't help you. I didn't get it is not going to help you when they suck all that money out of your account.
That's absolutely correct. And the other important thing, I know I've said this a lot of times, but the IRS sends you notices by U.S. mail. They are not going to send you an email or a text message or contact you through social media to ask for your personal information. I know.
Yeah, I love that. I could just see that. Hey, I got a message on my Facebook page from the IRS.
Right. Yeah. So that's not going to happen. But it is important, though, for taxpayers to, like you said, not bury your head in the sand, because you may be waiving important rights.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and again, it's just one of those things where, again, like in most things in life, you're better off being informed and taking action versus, wishing and hoping it's going to go away. Let's talk about this. Who will be helping the IRS collect taxes in 2017? This kind of blew me away, but I want you to tell everybody what's going on in 2017.
Well, back in December of last year, there was a bill that was signed into action that the IRS now has the ability to contract with private debt collectors. And these are, there's several different companies that are going to be collecting debts. And I won't go through the list of them, but they are people who have been hired to collect debt that the IRS may sort of have given up on, so to speak. And there's some criteria about when the debt collection agencies will actually work on the debt. That's one of them. But the important thing to know is that, and this goes back to the mail issue, the IRS is going to send out written notice that a taxpayer's account is being transferred to a private collection agency. And one of the reasons, of course, that this is important is because of all of the scams that I've talked about before. And so you want to know if your account has been transferred to one of these agencies so you know if it is a real collection agency or if it's somebody who's just trying to get your personal information.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, that's incredible. You know, and I'm sure that the IRS, debt collection industry is probably jumping up and down. They have a new client and a fairly big one at that. And in some cases, I think this is kind of good news for the consumer because if you're intimidated or afraid of the IRS, maybe a collection agency might be, for some people, it might be a better step. At least, you know, maybe it won't be completely ignored and maybe they'll take some action and stuff like that. And I think that the other thing I like about the collection industry getting involved is that they have some regulations and there's some, and they have to fall within the debt collection laws. So that's good too.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And that's also one of the items that was brought to light is these debt collection agencies, even though they are acting as agents or contractors of the IRS, they still have to abide by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. They have, certain times they can call, they have certain things that they can say. If you say to them, I don't want you to contact me anymore, they do have to cease that. They can't continuously just call and call and call. So they can't call people at their places of employment or contact people who are represented by an attorney. So you're right. I mean, it may be better, it may be worse. We don't know. The IRS has had private debt collectors in the past. It didn't really work out that well. So, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is trial and error. And you're right. I mean, bottom line, who knows? And, some people are offended when a collection agency contacts them, but bottom line is the IRS is not going to go away. I wanted to ask you this real quick too. My understanding is that there is some changes in installment agreement terms. Talk about this. There's like an expanded, streamlined thingy going on.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's not too technical for anybody. Thingy, whatchamacallit, these are.
Well, yes. It's actually sort of a test run. The IRS has, they're starting what they call a pilot project. And the new expanded terms are going to be that, it used to be that they had a streamlined installment agreement that went up to a taxpayer owing $50,000. The new streamlined processing that they're going to do this pilot project on is for taxpayers who owe between $50,000 and $100,000. The previous streamlined installment agreement was for 72 months. This new one will be for 84 months. So, again, it's a pilot program. We'll see what happens. And it only is for certain types of taxpayers. It's not for everyone, for businesses or for people who owe payroll taxes. It is just for individuals and out of what they call out of business sole proprietors. So, again, it's a test run. We'll see if they adopt it sort of permanently.
Sure. This is going to sound funny, but I would love to owe the IRS $100,000.
That does sound funny, actually. I don't think any of my clients have said that.
Not only would I like to owe them $100,000, I'd like to be able to pay it with one check. That to me would be okay, you know. And since I'm dreaming about this, I would like the $100,000 to represent like a 4 or 5% tax rate after all my deductions and charitable contributions and gifting that I'm going to do.
That sounds wonderful to me.
Yeah, it does. This is great. All right, let's talk about this. Because I've always said, you know, one of the things that I like working with your company, with you as an attorney, is that a lot of the information that you and I are able to discuss has this privilege umbrella over it, and not the same thing with the CPA. So I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here. When it comes to dealing with a CPA, can a taxpayer get favorable penalty treatment based on upon reliance of their CPA? What do you think about that?
Well, there was another court case, and this one's only about a month old, and it actually said that, yes, if a taxpayer has relied on their CPA or their tax preparer, that they can get penalty abatement based on that. And apparently this has been one of those things where the circuit courts, they sort of disagree. You know, it depends on which circuit you're in. But when there are certain factors also that they took into account when they ruled this way, that the taxpayer, yes, could have the penalties abated. And one of those was that the taxpayer had no accounting experience. You know, he had not taken any accounting classes. He didn't work in a profession that required him to be an accountant or have accounting, you know, experience. He had a long relationship with the accounting firm. It wasn't just that he had gone there, you know, this particular year, and this was the year we had an issue. And they didn't have any reason to question what the firm had told them, that, yes, this amount was going to be deductible or it could be treated in this certain way. The other thing, and I think one of the other important things, is that the taxpayer had provided all the information to the accounting firm, and that they didn't think that they had left anything out or there was any false information. But the most important factor for the court was that the taxpayer was not trained in tax matters, and, you know, he had a reasonable expectation that the accounting firm would get the tax return correct.
Gotcha. A lot of conditions.
There's a lot of conditions, absolutely. So and that's another thing about penalty abatement. It's important to, you know, go over the situation and be sure that, you know, the taxpayer meets the criteria for penalty abatement.
Yeah. And you know, this kind of reminds me, and some of you guys won't even know who I'm talking about, but this kind of reminds me of what happened to Willie Nelson, right? Back in the day, remember he relied on some tax advice from some big CPA firm, and it turned out not to be correct, and they hit him really hard. That it immediately reminded me of that, and I know that it went through a big legal process, and I think he eventually was, you know, he was made some kind of settlement work got worked out between him and his CPA firm, but back in the day he relied on them, and it didn't work out really well for him, and so it seems like maybe this law is going to help certain people, depending on depending on the district they're in?
Depending on the circuit they're in, and, of course, the factors in the individual case. I mean, if you have somebody who, you know, he's a, you know, a comptroller or something for a company but doesn't do tax returns, you know, he's going to be held to a higher standard than someone who, you know, works as a server or something.
Yeah, because obviously a controller is expected to have some knowledge about numbers, taxes, money, and things like that, as opposed to a server what do you call it, a radio show host who,
right,
obviously is not expected to know a whole lot. Thank goodness, we're just you know. Anyway, but this is great stuff. And we're out of time, Mary. Unfortunately, I have to say goodbye. But this has been excellent information. And if you guys have questions about your taxes, you want to find out what's going on, you want to get some talk to Mary and get some advice. You can go to Florida, TaxLawyerFlorida.com, TaxLawyerFlorida.com. You can connect with their team. They can help you out. They can, if they can't help you, they'll refer you to somebody who can. But it's TaxLawyerFlorida.com. They help people like myself across the nation. And Mary King, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Have a great time at Universal.
You bet. Good stuff there from Mary King. And we are enjoying our week here at Universal Studios. And we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. My next guest, Al Casado, president and owner of CKS Summit Group, founded in 1996. Al's focus and objective is to help ensure his clients are able to enjoy their lifestyle beyond the workplace and into their retirement years. He educates and enables them to come to understand for themselves the financial path they should follow. He has spent 20 years helping clients protect and preserve their assets. His safe money strategies helps clients save millions of dollars during the latest market collapse. Al is an asset preservation consultant and transitional planning specialist. Al Casado, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about this, because interestingly enough, you have this catch-up rule. So let's talk about this catch-up rule of yours. What is this all about?
Well, what this is talking about is about 401 catch-up contributions. And, a while back, policymakers got together, and they came up with a plan to help older workers boost their retirement savings by allowing what so-called catch-up contributions. And at the time, it kind of seemed like a really good fix, because after all, who wouldn't want to sock away money and tax deferral, for later in life? But the problem happened is that researchers have found that only a small minority of the millions of people saving through their retirement plans have actually used it, because what the Tax Act, what it allowed basically was that the plan contributor can put up an additional 33% into their 401k. So if you are over age 50, you can contribute another $6,000 into that 401k. So it was allowing older workers who hadn't saved enough or wanted to save more the opportunity to do so.
Gotcha. But what I understand from what you're saying there is that not a lot of people take advantage of this, right?
They really have found out is that, people get used to what they put in. For example, if they're already putting in 5% or 10%, they found that it's very hard for somebody, once they get stuck in their mind a number, to actually increase that number to create more. And what they really found out is that really the higher income earners are the ones that really took advantage of it. Those with average incomes of $163,000 and net worths of over $400,000 are the ones that really took a lot, or have been the ones that have really been taking advantage of that, while the average 401k contributor, who's roughly, income about $57,000, net worth about $200,000, really hasn't jumped on that and been able to take advantage of the opportunity to put more money away.
Gotcha. You know, it's interesting too. I think that as a nation, we struggle saving money. We just, you know, we used to be a nation of savers, and now we've become a nation of spenders. We just do not save money.
No, we don't. You can see, you know, if you look at all the research that's been done and how many people are going to retire in basic poverty, it's really alarming. And the fact that, you know, in retirement, people, a lot of people think they're going to need less income. And I know in our practice, what we found is that most people don't really want to, you know, today's retiree is very different. So they're not going into retirement thinking they're going to sit in a rocking chair. They're thinking they're going to go and travel and do this and do that. And they're still active. They're still in those go-go years, you know. And people are not realizing that you're going to still, you know, lifestyle. When it comes to retirement, it's about lifestyle. And to maintain lifestyle, you need to have income. And to have income, you need to have saved money. And somewhere, somehow, we become a society of instant gratification and delayed gratification that hasn't really entered the equation anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing what you said there, that back in the day, retirement really meant, for the most part, you know, you would leave the work environment and you kind of just piddle around the house. But now that's changed. Really, most people, especially I'm in my 50s, and most people that I talk to that are my age or slightly older are definitely thinking about spending their time traveling. I talked to one gentleman the other day, and he plans, you know, he wants to die broke, right? He's not planning on leaving any money to his children, and there's nothing wrong with that. Ideally, I think that's the way we should all plan, right? That your last breath coincides with your last dollar. That would be perfect. Unrealistic.
That would be perfect.
Planning. That would be perfect. Yeah.
Absolutely. That would be exceptional planning.
Absolutely. Wouldn't that just be just the way to do it? Let me ask you this. Back up to this this catch-up rule that we're talking about. Who could take advantage of this? Is this open to anybody?
No, ages 50 and up. So basically, if your age is 50 and up, yeah, you can put in an additional $6,000 a year into your 401k. So basically, what they're doing is they're allowing you to do that. But you know, it's just you know, a lot of people are finding it tough. You know, if they start at 50 to try to catch up, you know, especially with our economic conditions that we're in, then all of a sudden now you got to cross your fingers, cross your toes, and your legs to make sure that the market helps you, so that the catch ups, you know, the additional money that you're putting in are not being wiped out by market losses. So there's a lot of challenges right now within 401ks, because there's limitations to 401ks also. You know, they really don't give you safe places to put money or anything like that. So you're basically at the mercy of whatever the markets do. So it also puts a lot of stress on people today that are trying to catch up and saying, geez, but, you know, are the markets going to help me for the next, you know, 5, 10 years or 15 years before I retire?
Yeah, I think that's what you call it. Very interesting. Very, you know, it's one of those situations where I think that what we all learned in 2007, 2008, that even though you've done everything right, you've worked, you did plan, you did save a bunch of money, it can also be reversed quite literally overnight.
Right. And that's why I think that, you know, I think one of the areas that the 401k needs to improve is to, you know, provide better safe harbors for assets, so that, because there's no rule that says you have to lose money. You know, the mentality of just kind of leaving money in there and coming back when you're getting close to it, when you have a 5 to 10 year window, you know, you can't afford to take any steps backwards, because again, it's years in recovery. I mean, it took 7 years from 2000 to 2007 to recover. And then when we had all those losses in 08, it took almost 6.5 years to get back to where you were. So, you know, one misstep in the market, and if you're getting close to that retirement age, can set you back. And then now you find yourself trying to go to plan B or C, and that's either working more or you know, taking on extra jobs or whatever, just to make sure they can maintain your lifestyle. So the key is to start early. The key is to maintain. The key is to be vigilant with that 401k and make sure that you're not just letting it sit.
Absolutely. No, I like what you're saying there, and I hope everybody really digs deep and listens to this very important advice, because what a lot of us do is we put money in and we're really hoping and wishing that it's all going to work out. But you really have to take responsibility, take charge, and as you said, be vigilant and diligent with your money, because one misstep could set you back 5, 6, 10 years, and that's a life changer.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You don't want to delay the good years that you have, because every time you take a loss, what you're doing is you're pretty much putting your goals and your wishes on hold. You want to be able to maintain and still take those trips you wanted to take, still go see the grandkids, still go travel, still do whatever it is that you need to do. You don't want to put life on hold because of mistakes you made financially.
Absolutely, absolutely. Al, we're out of time. Appreciate you stopping by today and helping us out with our 401. Looking forward to having you back again.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
All righty. Good stuff there from Al Caicedo, talking about you and your 401. It's such an important thing. Interestingly enough, you know, we've been talking quite a bit this week about our investments and our money, and that's not going to change anytime soon. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool. You
want
to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, who's next?
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All righty, we are back. My next guest, Thomas Stirner. Thomas M. Stirner is the author of Fully Engaged and The Practicing Mind. He is accomplished as a musician, composer, and technician in various fields of music, as a recording and audio engineer, and in athletic pursuits, which from archery to golf. He speaks around the world on developing focus and discipline in our lives and lives in Wilmington, Delaware. And you can visit him at Tom Stirner, Stirner.com. Thomas Stirner, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks, Bert. It's great to be here.
I'm excited to have you here, and I love the title of your book, Fully Engaged. Let's talk about this. Tell us a little about the title. What do you mean about being fully engaged?
Well, what the studies, the Western empirical studies are showing us is that we're losing our ability to be focused for any length of time, to hold our focus. You see it in so many areas. I was just talking to my web team, and they were saying that, you know, statistically, for every second a page takes to load, you lose a certain percentage of your viewers. So, I mean, that's really the state of affairs, you know, for us. People have a very short attention span. And some of this is coming from just the lifestyle. A lot of it is also, it keeps ramping up. So we have these situations where everything happens at a faster speed, so the mind has to happen at a faster speed. And when it's accommodating that, as an evolutionary thing, but at the same time, when we ask our mind to stop and focus, to reel it in and focus on one particular task, it doesn't want to do that. In fact, we're really kind of losing the ability to do that. So fully engaged means relearning how to be completely absorbed in the process of what you're doing and to be more attached to the process of achieving your goal, whatever that is, as opposed to being attached to the moment that the goal is realized.
Gotcha, gotcha. You know, and it's funny too, because it seems like more now than ever, we have become a generation not only lack of focus, but completely distracted, right? Everybody's always on their phone or their device, and the thing that makes it even worse are all these apps that make your phone more and more efficient, so it gives you more and more reasons to have your phone with you at all times.
Yeah, I mean, the phone is not really a phone anymore. It's just a computer that we carry around in our pocket. And you're right. The people live and function in a state of distraction, and it feels perfectly normal because that's the way that they go through their life. Now, what's concerning is that a lot of people, when I was listening to the show before this, you know, you were talking about your age being in the 50s, and, you know, that generation, our generation, came up at a time where there were no smartphones, and that initially there was only a couple of channels on the television. But the kids that are coming up now, the younger generation, they've been raised on this in this paradigm where there's just constant mental stimulation. And for them, that, you know, you see, it's like I remember the days of, you know, AOL, where, you know, you had to, it took 30 seconds for something to happen. You know, now if something doesn't happen immediately, we're impatient. And that's because our mind is operating so quickly. And we're losing the skill of being able to reel our mind in and focus. And that's very important for anything that we want to do. If we can't pay attention, then we're really not in control of what's going on.
Absolutely. You know, and what's, what I have seen, and again, because for a lot of people I'm considered an old man now, when my wife and I go out to a restaurant, we'll see a young couple, and they're both on their devices. And it's just like, you know, and some people say, yeah, you know, I bet you they're texting each other, which is possibly true, but bottom line is they're both on their devices instead of communicating with each other. So it just, you know, it's just we're in a weird time in our life when you have so many young people who rather interact with a device than sit there and just talk to somebody.
Well, you're so right with that. And what I love about it is all of the marketing media, the advertisement for it is stay connected. You know, you're connected with somebody that's not even there, but you're not talking to the person that's right next to you. And, you know, I'm one of the things that I do for fun is sailing. And I read an article in a sailing magazine where the guy, the editor said that he had gone to the Caribbean for a vacation, and he was in the marina sitting on his sailboat. And he said, there's this indescribably beautiful sunset happening. He said, and in the sailboat right next to him, in the next slip, is a family of four that had come down. There are two adults and two young kids, like teenage kids. He said, the sunset is going on, and all four, the two parents are on each of their iPads, and the two kids are on their smartphones. None of them are watching the sunset. So they came here for this environment, and they're not even noticing it because they're so addicted to what is happening on their device. And it is. They're saying now that it even creates like a kind of a simulated high in the brain, and it's almost like a form of addiction.
Yes, absolutely. You know, my girls, we have two girls left at home, and my twins are unique in the sense that they did not get a phone until they were 14, which was an oddity in their school. They were known as the girls who didn't have phones. But because of that, they're not as addicted to it, right? They have a lot of their friends who walk and look down constantly. This is, you know, we are now facing a weird, almost zombie-like generation, because a lot of these young kids walk with their face looking down at their phone or device versus, as you said, taking, you know, seeing what's in front of them or taking in the majesty of a sunset or the beauty of a sunset. It's such a weird thing.
Well, they're saying that one of the real concerns in the generations that are coming up is the loss of an ability to communicate and interact socially very well, because everything that they do is through texting and a phone. And it's, you know, people, they almost feel a sense of fear when they don't have access to their phone. You know, like what's actually going to happen on the phone in an hour or so that it's really going to make any difference. I mean, I remember when the smartphones first came out, it was great because, well, I shouldn't say smartphones, the cell phones first came out, because they were really wonderful if you had somebody in the family and they were going out in the evening and you knew that they had a way of contacting you if they had a problem. But like I said, now it's you see the younger people, they're having text conversations with half a dozen people at the same time. And and like I said, what this is doing, there's a book out by Nicholas Carr called, it's been out for a while now, called What the Internet is Doing to Our Brain. It's what it's talking about, this is this lifestyle is eroding our ability to focus, and we're not paying attention to it, and we need to start paying attention to it, because it's going to create a lot of problems for us.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about this, because Fully Engaged is your second book. Your first book is The Practicing Mind. So I'm not familiar with The Practicing Mind. What is The Practicing Mind about, and what it inspired you to write the second book?
Well, The Practicing Mind really deals with if we just define practice, you know, practice is the repetition of a process. And that process can be mental or it can be physical. It can be mentally, it can be making a good decision under stress. It could be taking away a golf swing. You know, either way, but the practicing, the art of practicing, is the repetition of a process with the intention of accomplishing a specific goal. And the practicing mind was about understanding what we've learned, not just from thousands of years of Eastern thought, but also what has been corroborated by the Western empirical science studies. And that is that we function at our highest level when we are totally absorbed in the present moment doing one thing. When we do that, we, as I've said many times, we accomplish more with less effort in less time. And the experience of accomplishing it is one of contentment and peace. And interestingly, you know, your last guest was talking about investing. A lot of people that have contacted me after reading The Practicing Mind have been investment people, because they have applied what was talked about in that book in the whole process of building wealth. And it's really understanding the relationship of setting a goal and using the goal as a rudder instead of something that reminds you of what you haven't accomplished yet. And then immersing yourself in the process of achieving that goal so that you can experience the enjoyment of achieving it. Because really the only reason a goal means anything when it's accomplished is because of what you went through to get to that point. If you think about it, anything that's come very easily doesn't mean anything to you. It's the things that you've had to apply yourself for, you've had to develop skills, you've had to apply a certain amount of discipline. And when I talk about discipline, I'm talking about the I'm not talking necessarily about Navy SEAL discipline where you can hold your breath under 40 degree water for 10 minutes. I'm talking about you know, the ability to pick a goal and to work towards that goal and enjoy the process of accomplishing it in the least amount of time by being completely absorbed in the process. So The Practicing Mind really came from that. And when that book was released, I originally self-published it in 2006, and it did so well that it got picked up by New World Library and was second edition was put out. The impact of it was really way more than I ever expected. It's out in a bunch of languages, and the everybody that read it wanted. They said the one criticism was it wasn't long enough. They wanted to talk about the subject more. They wanted to hear more about it. And initially, I didn't think I had anything more to say. But after it created this whole career for me because I had a business before that, and I did ended up doing so much coaching and speaking and workshop type things. That I found that people were not only wanting to talk more about the subject, but they were asking very similar questions over and over again. So that was when I thought, well, you know, I think I'll do a follow-up called Fully Engaged, which really could have also been looked at as another chapter. It could have just been a continuation of the practicing mind, but that's where the Fully Engaged came from.
Yeah, I like that. And I like what you said about enjoying the process of achievement, right? I think Jim Rome or Tony Robbins or some of these other guys talked about, you know, you cannot achieve to be happy. You have to happily achieve, because that's, as you said, that's really where the value comes in. Look, if you set a goal to do X and you don't have to struggle for it, then you're not going to learn anything. You don't become a better person. You don't, you're not learning anything. You're not, there's no reason to be fully engaged in the process because you're not going to enjoy it. It's because it doesn't mean anything, as opposed to setting a goal and struggling months or years to achieve that goal. When you get there, it means something. And there's the process that you become a different person in order to achieve that goal.
That's true. And if you look at the two things of setting a goal and then the process of achieving it, 99% of the time, you're in the process. You're only in the part of achievement for a very short period of time. You know, so if you can learn to flip-flop that so that your enjoyment is coming from the process of achieving the goal, it completely transforms your experience of accomplishing anything.
Absolutely. You know what? I also want to talk about this. I want to talk about thought awareness training and the benefits. So why don't you, first of all, give us your definition of thought awareness training, and then let's talk about the benefits.
Well, thought awareness training is learning first of all, becoming aware that you are not your thoughts. You are the one that experiences your thoughts. And some of those thoughts you create through your intention, but most of the thoughts that you have during the day are created by your mind without your permission and many times without your awareness. There's a very big difference between having a thought and being in your thoughts. They're two different perspectives. When you have a thought, you're more of an observer of the thoughts that your mind is producing. When you're in your thoughts, you're completely absorbed in the emotional content of the thought. And so your mind is running around during the day, and it's reacting to stimulus. You got some bad news, you got some good news. Somebody says something nice to you, you feel good, you know, then you react to that. Somebody gives you some bad news, you react to that. And you're just experiencing whatever emotional content is the result of that thought. Because if you ask people, if you didn't think, could you worry? Well, the answer is no, because thought is the vehicle of everything in terms of the emotional responses. So what thought awareness training does is it teaches you, number one, to be aware of what your mind is doing. And as soon as you're aware, now you have a choice. You didn't have a choice when you weren't aware, but once you become aware, you have a choice. And the second thing it does is it builds your stamina and your ability to focus the mind in the direction that you want it to go so that it's serving you as opposed to you basically being a puppet of it. So thought awareness training, you can call it, that's just a label. You can call it meditation if you want. It's just a system of sitting down quietly. You want to be comfortable physically because you don't want your body to be a distraction. So you don't want your leg going to sleep or something like that. But the posture you take for the context of what we're talking about here really doesn't matter as long as you're comfortable. And then you don't want to be falling asleep either, but you want to be alert. You close your eyes, and there's two systems that you can use which are very standard. One is to just watch your body breathe, and the other is to just repeat some sort of a short mantra that you're comfortable with. And the words don't matter. I just don't think they should be more than about three words, because it just gets harder to repeat that over and over again. All you're really doing is giving your mind one thing to focus on, so that you're aware that your mind is supposed to do this. You just want something very simple. I'm just going to watch myself breathe. The temptation, if you're doing that, is to control your breathing, because you start to say to yourself, well, I think I'll try to slow my breath down. See, that's all the ego getting involved. And now, you know, your body knows how to breathe. Just forget that. Just sit there and watch yourself breathe. Relax and release from that. And or if you're saying the mantra, you just repeat the mantra over and over again with your eyes closed. And the reason you close your eyes is so you don't have visual stimulus going on, lights changing outside or whatever. And what will happen is, very quickly into the process, you'll find out that your mind will go off in a direction to problem solve, because the mind loves to problem solve. And if you don't give it a problem to solve, it'll go looking for one. And you won't even be aware of it, because it's a habituated response that you've experienced your whole life, and you don't notice it. And your mind will run off, and it'll go, you'll be at the grocery store or working on a report at work or whatever, and you'll have this instant where you wake up and you realize, I'm not paying attention to my breath, or I'm not saying my mantra, or I'm saying my mantra, but I'm not really paying attention to it because I'm thinking about this other thing. And when that happens, you just bring your mind back to task. That's all there is to it. But this sounds deceptively simple. The mistake that people make is that when they start to do that, they misunderstand the goal. And the practice of it is just to do that, to catch the mind and bring it back, catch the mind, bring it back. People do that and they think, when I can hold my attention on my breath, or I can hold my attention on my mantra all the time, then I'll be happy. And that's not true. Nobody can do that. That's not the point. The point is that by doing this, every time you catch the mind, you wake up, and your awareness of what your mind is doing without your permission grows, and your ability to pull it back gets a little bit stronger. It's a very subtle experience, but it pays huge dividends. If only the stock market worked that way. I mean, what happens is that you will find that you will begin to have somebody will say something that may have irritated you or upset you, and you will feel very separate from that whole experience. You will just notice it. You'll notice there might be a slight impulse to be upset, but it will not be without your outside of your control, and you will just stop it. You will make the decision, no, I'm not going to. It's like it puts you out ahead of the emotional response, and you will just say, no, I'm not going to allow this thought to run, because it's going to take me someplace that I don't feel like going right now. It's amazing how it works. It doesn't take very much time. I mean, you do 10, 15 minutes a day, and the other thing you don't want to do is judge yourself if, you know, you have a bad day and you don't do it. That's another thing people do, is they start to come down on themselves because they think, well, I missed a day. Well, then you just start up again. There's no judgment in it, and there's no such thing as a bad meditation. Some days you'll chase your mind a lot. Some days you won't. It just depends on where your head's at, what's going on in your life. And I'm always amused when people say, I'm really bad at meditation because I'm always chasing my mind. And my response is, well, you couldn't be chasing your mind if you weren't noticing what your mind is doing. And that is the goal, is to develop the ability to notice what your mind is doing. So if you're chasing your mind, it means you're noticing your mind. If you weren't noticing it, you would just be in the mind and going wherever it's going. So I think that it's very important for people to understand that. But if you cannot do that, if you're not aware of what your mind is doing during the day, you are not in control of what is going on within you. And that's really the center for all the peak performance studies, all the stuff in sports psychology, the top golfers. This is what they all work on, is being aware of their thoughts and being in control of their thinking and thinning out the number of thoughts that they have in a day.
You know, and what's interesting to me listening to you is we kind of do this anyway, don't we? The difference is, and that's why you call it thought awareness, because the difference is a lot of us do it unaware, right? We're just having this conversation, and we haven't thought about training our thoughts, and so we're doing this mantra or these affirmations anyway. And some of them, I would say, most of them are probably negative, such as I'm not, you know, I'm I'm too fat, or I'm too stupid, or I'm always running late, or I never have money, or whatever that dialogue is. And what I like about this idea of thought awareness training is that it makes you stop and to be aware of what thoughts you want to choose, because how you think or these thoughts determine how you feel.
Yes, I mean, your self-talk is everything about, you know, how you experience your day or how you experience a certain situation, and how you your whole interpretation of a situation is really reflected in your self-talk. So what we're talking about here is becoming more an observer, and as you're an observer, it's almost like you're watching somebody else have this thought, and it's really a wonderful perspective to be in, because if it's a thought that feels good, you can allow it to flow. If it's a thought that is going to raise your blood pressure, then, you know, it's a thought that you can stop. And people don't – we're not taught that we can do this, but we can do this. People do it all the time. It's where, you know, you look at people that are worrying, and if you were to say to them, well, you're worrying because you're having a worrying thought. So if you stop having that thought, the experience of worrying will diminish greatly. You know, it's not something like anything else, like learning to play the piano or anything else. You don't start out today and have a certain level of proficiency. You know, you always start, whenever you're learning any skill, and this is a skill, is you start from a position of no skill. And then you start moving on this line of skill mastery. And so you have to understand that it's perfectly normal to not be able to do this all the time. It's really, I tell people, it's like exercising. You know, there's never a point in your life when you don't need to exercise. The body needs to be exercised. It's part of a healthy lifestyle. This is part of a healthy lifestyle in terms of developing self-control and self-awareness of what you're actually exposing yourself to by the thought processes that are going on in your mind.
Yeah, no, I like it. And you know what? It's I think probably the most important training that you could do. If you want to achieve big goals, right? Go ahead.
Absolutely, because it not only gives you freedom of choice of how you're thinking, but when you set goals, you have you can tell things like, am I becoming, you know, when you become attached to the goal itself, then your performance goes way down because your mind is no longer in the process of accomplishing the goal. Your mind is completely attached and holding on to this moment out here in the future. And I think that's another area where people make mistakes. It's when they set goals, they set themselves up for failure because they don't have enough data to understand everything that's involved in accomplishing the goal. And it could be many times that you can't have enough debt. You can't know everything that's going to happen. Now, I guess a perfect example of that would be, you know, you could say, well, I want to invest this money, and it should take me this long to turn this money into this much money. But how could you possibly know that? I mean, the market's going to change. There are all these things out there that are volatile that you can't know. Now, I think for people that are involved in investing, that makes perfect sense to them. But in so many other goals that they select in their life, they don't apply that same awareness. And what they do is they set a goal, and then they subconsciously come up with some sort of a time frame as to how long it should take to accomplish the goal. And then they begin this process of judging how well they're doing based on where they are in that timeline. But the timeline might be completely inaccurate. So it's very important. But you can't have – again, you can't do any of that stuff. You can't self-analyze if you're just in your thoughts. Your mind is just creating these thoughts all day long, and it's reacting to whatever situation is in front of it, and you're just going along for the ride. And we all know people like this. You can watch people that are in this. That's their paradigm. That's how they react to life. It's how they process their day. And boy, they're just worn out by the end of the day.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thomas Sterner, we're out of time. Thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to having you back again, my friend. This has been a lot of fun. I love this idea of thought awareness training. The book is called Fully Engaged. You can find it on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. Thomas Sterner, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks, Bert. It was a total pleasure.
Good stuff there from Thomas Sterner. And the book, again, is Fully Engaged. I love the idea of thought thought awareness training. It's vital. It's probably the most important thing to do every day. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.